It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Good morning to you guys. Everything is going to start right here where we are located, which is the funeral home back here. And the family is going to be meeting here a little bit later this morning. And then they will escort the flag-draped casket carrying the former first president over to Ellington Field, where it will be loaded up onto Air Force One and flown a special mission today over to D.C. Look at this powerful image again. We're talking about this all morning, sent out by the president's office last night, showing the president's service dog Sully keeping watch. The caption reading, mission complete. Here's Neil Bush, one of the president's sons, reflecting on his father's storied life.
He's had such an incredible impact, not because he's a lecturer or because he, you know, is trying to tell us how to behave, but because he led such an amazing life as a role model. He's probably the best man I know in terms of everything you would want in a man. He was a great husband, an amazing dad.
Later today, the former president will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol and all day tomorrow through Wednesday morning. Wednesday then, the National Day of Mourning, and the state funeral will be held at 11 o'clock Eastern Time at the Washington National Cathedral. From there, it is back to Texas, where Mr. Bush will lie in repose at St. Martin's Episcopal Church around the corner from us here in Houston. And then there will be a second funeral service at that church Thursday morning before the president's body is finally taken by train from here up to his presidential library and museum in College Station, Texas, where he will be laid to rest next to his beloved Barbara and their daughter Robin, who died of leukemia at a young age.
Sandy Rios with you. Well, I'm sure you've been watching the news as George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president of the United States, has been memorialized. You know, honestly, I don't think there has been a president in modern times who had more qualifications than he had to actually hold that office. He reminds us of what the presidency used to be. It used to be reserved for people who had extremely exemplary lives and service. But that sort of changed. That's changed. I actually think it changed when Bill Clinton came to office. Obviously, it was different when John Kennedy served, too. He had a really wretched personal life, and yet no one ever talked about that. But George Herbert Walker Bush checked all the boxes, and I don't mean that tritely. I mean, he really served his country faithfully, loved his family, and he was an exemplary example as a man. There's no question about that. I think one of the most interesting things about him, which I'm sure you've heard, you've probably seen the video, when he was 20 years old, he was a Navy pilot. He earned a Distinguished Flying Cross. I actually think he joined when he was 19. Left college. He came from a very wealthy family. He didn't have to do that, but he did it. He was on a bombing run. He was flying, as I understand it, a very dangerous plane because of the way it was constructed. And he was supposed to bomb a Japanese radio station. And he and his other two crew members were hit by anti-aircraft fire, but he proceeded in that plane anyway. He said, "We were trained to complete our runs no matter what the obstacle." And then completed, he did, turned around, and then they saw that they just couldn't make it, and he gave the orders to bail out. He bailed out, but the other two crew members, as best we can tell, washed up on the shore. It was the very island they had just bombed, and some have said that they were tortured, maybe decapitated, because that's what the Japanese did to American soldiers. Another part of our history that we tend to not talk about. Why that, you know, just amazing the treatment that our men received during World War II. Starved to death, tortured, was just a horrible story. But he was saved, and he actually asked later, you know, "God, why did you spare me, and for what purpose?" He flew 58 combat missions over the Pacific. And you can see there's a video of him being pulled to the submarine, which ended up saving him. I think he was in the water for 4 or 5 hours because he had swum to try to get away from, you know, he was strong. He was from a family that did a lot of, you can see in all the videos how athletic he was. He was a star athlete, and he swam away from that island and floated in that water for 4 to 5 hours. And then they were able to rescue him. And of course his buddies did not live. And then again, so that's the story. That's just a partial story. Out of that, again, he won so many. He won the Distinguished Flying Cross and several other things as he was in service. Now, that makes this story even more interesting because the AP, as soon as they heard that he had died, and by the way, they said that he died, just the last thing he said, he told his son, George W. Bush, "I love you." So the AP, this is what they reported. They tweeted this, George H.W. Bush, a patrician New Englander whose presidency soared with the coalition victory over Iraq and Kuwait, but then plummeted in the throes of a weak economy that led voters to turn him out of office after a single term, has died. He was 94. That's what the AP had to say about this man. And so many people were very upset about it. Some of the comments, Elliot Hamilton says, "Let the record forever reflect that the Associated Press is not an even-handed news organization, but rather an agenda-driven press agency that would be willing to prop up Hitler and Castro than to rightfully honor the imperfect men and women who served this country with dignity." And there are a lot more comments than that. But you can see, and I think it's a good illustration, again, the AP used to be such a trusted source, but not so trusted anymore. So we're going to come back to George Herbert Walker Bush in a little bit because I have a friend who worked with him a bit and has this great story, and he's going to join us to tell that. But speaking of the AP, here's another headline that took place in the last few days. The AP retracts a call in North Carolina congressional race amid fraud investigation. Okay, so what's that all about? That's about Pastor Mark Harris. Pastor Mark Harris won that battle against Dan McCready, and remember, the genesis of their rivalry is over the same-sex marriage or the bathroom bill in North Carolina. Pastor Mark Harris used to be the president of the Southern Baptist Convention there, but he has been absorbing himself in politics, and from my perspective, has not changed a whit in terms of his principle. And he won the election by 905 votes, but now all of a sudden, they've decided he can't be certified. He was certified. They're withdrawing the certification. Why? Because the chairman of their election board said he had heard that some things untoward had happened in one district. I think they got 6 different email from people alleging particular voter irregularities. And so they are refusing to certify Mark Harris. This is the exact statement. What I'm hearing is that there's some irregularities going on within the absentee ballots out in the field after we mail them. I've heard rumors and allegations, but as far as facts, I haven't heard very many. Nevertheless, they're holding up Mark Harris's election, and a friend of mine said it's interesting. They're holding up that election, which, of course, how dare they? While in California, we're hearing reports about other things, and I want to spend the rest of my time talking to you about this. Let me just read from this particular report. As the polls closed on election day last month, 6 California Republican House candidates, including Dana Rohrabacher, Steve Knight, Mimi Walters, were ahead in their respective races. However, as the absentee and provisional ballots rolled in over the intervening weeks, all 6 lost to their Democratic opponents. The case of Korean-American GOP candidate Young Kim was one of the most prominent examples. On election night, Kim held an 8,000-vote lead over her Democratic opponent, Gil Cisneros, and even attended freshman orientation in Washington before watching her lead and her victory slowly evaporate over subsequent weeks. So what happened there? Well, I'll tell you what happened. I'll tell you one thing. What's called vote harvesting, ballot harvesting. It was a bill or provision passed and signed by the governor in 2016, and nobody really was paying attention except for a few. And what it did is allowed voters to give any third party, not just a relative or someone living in the same household, the ability to collect and turn in anyone else's completed ballot. It's called ballot harvesting. In fact, this is a girl, Lulu, who was going door to door harvesting ballots. We have a little clip of this. You can hear how this works. Let's listen.
Hey, I'm looking for Brandy.
Who is it?
It's Lulu. I'm coming. Came here to pick up your ballot.
Oh, what do
you mean? Yeah, we're offering this new service, but only to, like, people who are supporting the Democratic Party. It's a service. I'm just trying to pick up your ballot and show you how to do it if you don't know.
Came here to pick up my ballot.
Yeah, it's new. Bill just passed last year at the end, so there's been a problem with, like, people, like, half the ballots that were mailed out last year didn't get back. A lot of people weren't signing the envelope in the back and stuff, but...
All right, you know, that's enough of that, but you get the gist of it. So they're going door to door, and also there's another law that California passed. There's a whole series of them, which we will post this. This is an article published by To The Point News and written by Sean Steele, who talks about, I'll just read what he says. Young Kim was poised to be the first Korean-American woman elected to Congress. Her 14-point lead was the lone bright spot on an otherwise dismal night for Orange County. But over the past week, Republicans have watched the first-generation immigrants' lead evaporate. And she lost 1 week after the election. Okay, so then he goes and he goes down and tracks all of this. Non-citizen voting. California has expanded voter eligibility, with some communities granting illegal immigrants the right to vote. Inmate voting. Not to be outdone, neighboring Alameda organized taxpayer-funded voter registration drives in county jails to register a record number of inmates. Felon voting. California felons have been enfranchised. Motor voter fraud. Every person in California that interacts with the Department of Motor Vehicles is automatically registered to vote. 16 and 17-year-old pre-registration. Absentee ballots automatically mailed to every single voter. Ballot harvesting, which is what I was just talking to you about, where someone can just, you know, come to the door and take your ballot and help you fill it out. And you heard Lulu say, we're looking for Democratic voters. Conditional ballots. I have no time to talk about all of this, but we will put this on our Facebook page. And let me just say, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that 250,000 such ballots were used in Orange County alone, and they defeated every single Republican. This is what the Chronicle reported. This is a statement by Katie Merrill, who's the Democratic consultant deeply involved in this race. She said... In one Orange County household, for example, both the husband and wife were longtime Republicans. Democratic volunteers came by the house four times, each time asking to speak only with their 18-year-old daughter, a no-party preference voter, and asking if she wanted them to pick up her signed and completed ballot. The San Francisco Chronicle quoted Republicans who admitted that Democrats clearly beat them at the new game and that to compete, they will have to conduct their own ballot harvesting efforts. And this is what opponents of the bill had said. AB 1921 would allow anybody to walk into an elections office and hand over truckloads of vote-by-mail envelopes with ballots inside, no questions asked, no verified records kept. It amounts to an open invitation to large-scale vote-buying, voter coercion, granny farming, and automated forgery. AB 1921 solves no problem that a simple stamp can't solve. And here's the problem, of course. Now the Democrats have led the way on legalizing these methods of really stealing elections. They have legalized them. There's no need for them to do nothing. No charges can be brought because that's the way it went. And then meanwhile, speaking of elections, Brenda Snipes, remember her down in Broward County, the woman who had overseen so many voter fraud activities, miscounting ballots, losing others. She has decided she's going to take back her resignation, and now she's going to sue. So this is the way the left plays. This is the way the left plays. And so Republicans are going to have to get smart and going to have to play in that sandbox legally but forcefully and not give up. And if you wonder why the midterms turned out the way they did, that's the reason. Because the Democrats planned ahead through the ballot process and took, you know, things they should not have taken. All right, stay tuned because we're going to talk about George Herbert Walker Bush in more detail coming up next.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. 2019 is upon us, and we're going to be going back to Washington, D.C. and to Williamsburg. for our spiritual heritage tours. And if you've been wanting to go, maybe this is the year for you. These tours fill up several months in advance. And one of the reasons they do is because we have an actual historian, a professional historian that comes on our tour with us. His name is Stephen McDowell. He's the president of the Providence Foundation, and he knows more about early American history, especially the Christian influence on early American history. He knows more than anybody I know. So, if you want to go with us, you can find out more information at spiritualheritagetours.com. That's in June and September. Pick the month you want to go. Find out more information at spiritualheritagetours.com. That's spiritualheritagetours.com.
It gives an impetus to share your faith when you think you've got answers to objections that you expect people to bring up.
The American Family Studios video series, Intro to God's Revelation, featuring Dr. Richard Howe, shows how God has revealed Himself in nature and His Word, and how we can rightly understand what God has said.
These truths are just a part and parcel of the Christian life. It isn't just for the professional clergy.
Learn the fundamentals of how to approach and understand the Bible in an age of skepticism. This 6-week video curriculum is perfect for your Sunday school class or study group, and it can prepare you to give a defense of God's Word and how He speaks to us in nature.
Knowing whether and how God communicates is a safeguard against false claims about God communicating.
Intro to God's Revelation, DVDs and workbook, are available for purchase at afastore.net or call 877-927-4917.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Paul Kizito. I'm a junior biology major here at Truett McConnell, and I came from Uganda. What I love about TMU is number one is the heart of, you know, of just the school and the love for God, for Christ. You can see it once you step on the campus. Like, you can see it's best, like, the foundation for TMU is Christianity.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
The Christmas Grinches are yelling bah humbug at the First Lady's Christmas decorations. Their chief complaint? Mrs. Trump's red Christmas trees. Some critics call the White House Tannenbaum's blood trees. Others suggested Mrs. Trump was inspired by The Handmaid's Tale. Quite frankly, Mrs. Trump's decorations are elegant, and it was in keeping with the president's desire to bring Merry Christmas back to the White House. By the way, I don't seem to recall the mainstream media getting their tinsel in a twist over Mrs. Obama's Christmas decorations. Remember the dog topiaries made from garbage bags or the mouse-a-tongue Christmas ornaments? And for that matter, there was very little criticism when the Obamas considered removing the nativity scene from the White House. Their first Christmas in the White House, and the Obamas wanted to kick the baby Jesus to the curb. If that doesn't curdle your eggnog, I don't know what will. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. Well, George Herbert Walker Bush left us this past weekend on Friday night. And of course, his presence will be missed. One of the things he's best known for is the way he loved his kids. He would write to them and leave messages for them. And this is a clip that Jeb Bush posted just a few days ago of a reading of something he wrote to his own children. Let's listen.
Dear kids, this letter is about aging. Last year, there was only a tiny sense of time left, of sand running through the glass. I want to put this aging on hold for a while now. I don't expect to be on the A-team anymore, but I want to play golf with you, and I want to fish or throw shoes, and I want to rejoice in your victories, and I want to be there for you if you get a bad bounce in life, and no doubt you will, for the seas do indeed get rough. When I say be there, I mean in the game, in the lineup, viscerally involved in your lives, even though I might be miles away. If I shed tears easier now, try not to laugh at me, because I'll lose more saline, and that makes me feel like a sissy. And besides, it's okay to cry if you're a man, a happy man, me. All bushes cry easily when we're happy, or counting our blessings, or sad. As the summer finishes out and the seas get a little higher, the winds a little colder, I'll be making some notes so I can add to this report on getting older. Remember the old song, I'll be there ready when you are? Well, I'll be there ready when you are, for there's so much excitement ahead, so many grandkids to watch grow. If you need me, I'm here. Devotedly, Dad.
Boy, it makes you want to have a dad like that, doesn't it? He was America's dad and a great example to men everywhere. Well, Paul Caprio has joined us this morning. Paul is a very dear friend of mine, and he's a political operative who's been around for a very long time, doing such incredible, effective things that you probably never heard about. Let me just say that Paul is the president of Family PAC Federal and Patriotic Veterans, among all the other hats that he wears. He was a contemporary of William Clinton at Georgetown University, which is a whole other story for another day. But I've asked Paul to join us this morning because his life intersected George Herbert Walker Bush's some time ago. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Sandy. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I would love to hear your story, and I want my listeners to hear when it was that you met George Herbert Walker Bush. Can you tell us?
Sure. I was a junior at Georgetown in Washington. I was also the Region 3 director of the College Republicans at that time, which encompassed five states. And one of my responsibilities was to get Republican speakers and congressmen to speak at some of the college Republican clubs in the area, especially some of the clubs that had supported me for my election. So I was working part-time for Buzz Lukens, who was a very conservative congressman from Ohio, and he was helpful in getting George Bush to accept my invitation to go down to Lynchburg, Virginia, to what was then called Randolph-Macon Women's College, to give a speech to the college Republicans down there. Do you want me to go through the entire story, Sandy? How much time do you have?
Yeah, no, I do, because you're a great storyteller, Paul,
okay.
So I'm just turning you loose.
So I met him. I met the then first-term congressman from Houston on the steps of the House office building. He had just come out of the gym. He had his tie in his hand. We were running a little late. He said to me, would you mind driving out to the airport? I need to put my tie on, get kind of freshened up. And so I said, fine. Of course, he didn't know that I didn't have a driver's license at the time, although I knew how to drive. I had learned how to drive on a farm. Anyway, we drove out, we got on the Piedmont Airlines plane, we went down to Lynchburg, rented another car there. He gave his speech to Randolph-Macon Women's College Young Republicans. About 9 o'clock or so, we went ahead, and the next stop was over to Washington and Lee University across the mountains in Lexington, Virginia. And my friend Jeff Wainscott, who is a Republican ally of ours, was the president of that organization. So he made the mistake of saying to me, Paul, why don't you drive for a while? And this was a very desolate road that we were on for way too long a period of time. So I started out driving. After a while, I hit a deer. The right side headlight went completely out. Got back in the car, so we now had one headlight on this road. There was absolutely no lighting on this road. And the only thing I remember about this drive was an old gas station over on the left side of the road. It was a two-lane highway. So after hitting the deer, he said, you know, we're both really tired. I was not only embarrassed at what had happened, But I was scared to death because I didn't have a driver's license, which he didn't know. So at that point, though, he was very comforting about the whole thing. He said, "Listen, we've both been had a long day. Let me drive the rest of the way." And even with him driving, it was quite a perilous drive. I mean, Lucinda and I have been out in Arizona, you know, through some mountains and some really perilous driving, and that's what that night reminded me of. But anyway, we got over to Lexington. He gave a speech in the morning. We flew back to Washington. So that was my first encounter with George Bush.
You know what?
And then, you're not aware of this, but after that, I then met him in 1974. We organized a Kentucky Fried Chicken dinner in Chicago, which he was very intrigued by because we only charged $12 for the dinner to get a lot of young people involved. And he liked all that. He was telling us this would be a great concept for Republicans across the country. And then, of course, I encountered him again in 1992 at the Republican convention. I was down at the convention with someone you know, Larry Hart, and also my friend Bob Spindell. They were talking about, well, you lived in Houston for a long time. What do you know? You know, what were George Bush's haunts, so to speak? And I said, well, what I know is he used to go to Otto's Barbecue in Houston. I went over with Larry, who, as you know, is a very diminutive person. We went over just to show him to have a barbecue at this place where George Bush used to go. So lo and behold, we're on the barbecue line. All of a sudden, I see media people coming in on one side of this barbecue room, setting up, and then after that, I see Secret Service people coming in, and I said to Larry, I said, you know, I wonder if Dan Quayle is coming over here to have barbecue, too. Lo and behold, and there was this kind of like a split-level barbecue. There was an upper room and a lower room where the barbecue was served. In the upper room, they brought him in. The Secret Service brought George Bush in through the upper room. He had come over to have barbecue, too. And so as he went down the line, I said to Larry, there were a lot of people waiting to shake his hand. I said, Larry, get in front of me. I've shaken hands with him before. And he saw me behind, you know, Larry being very short, me being taller, he saw me, and lo and behold, he said to me, Paul, where are you now? Are you still in Texas? Somebody told me you were in Illinois, which was, I think, his remembrance from, you know, this dinner in Illinois. That told me that this man had a photographic memory. And several other people had told me along the way, you know, George Bush has a photographic memory, and I never thought twice about it. But I became convinced in my own mind after that experience that he had a photographic memory.
Paul, let me ask a couple of questions. When that first meeting that you had when you were just a kid, really, you're a junior in college, and he's a freshman congressman. Did you sense, and this is just an honest question, let me caveat this with saying, I want to just tell people it's funny, because when Herbert Walker Bush was running, he was my choice over Reagan in the primary, which is interesting, because I found I really liked him. Did you see anything in him that hinted at greatness or future? Did you think this guy could be future president, or did he seem ordinary to you?
No, he was on, you know, when they talk about Supreme Court justices, they say, you know, this guy was in the Justice Department, he was in the fast lane. I always thought that he was in the fast lane of the Republican Party. You know, we were living in a time where, I'm not saying he would be a nominee for president in 1968, he hadn't had enough, you know, political background, although he'd lost twice for U.S. Senate in Texas by that time. But he was in the fast lane. I mean, he knew he knew with his photographic memory, he knew all the Republican players and donors in virtually every state. I think it's fair to say almost everyone admired him and had great respect for him. He was in the fast lane for the future. Keep in mind, politics was very different then. By 73, the Supreme Court had weighed in, unfortunately, on Roe v. Wade, really the beginning of the social controversies that not only tore the country apart, but to a certain extent, divided the party. So in 1968, although it was, quite a year in terms of protest, the social issues really hadn't come to play. So people weren't thinking about candidates that way. I mean, the party was split, Rockefeller versus Goldwater. I was on the Goldwater side. He was in Texas attempting to go down the middle between those two factions. The Texas Republican Party was very badly split at that time between certain what you would call yes. moderate Republicans and conservatives.
Paul, we're going to run out of time.
But he was he was on the fast lane for the
okay.
future.
Yeah, no, I get that. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I would really love, if you can do it in a couple of minutes, your perspective on him as a president. I made the comment before you joined us that he was perhaps one of the best qualified men to ever serve in that office. His accomplishments prior to taking the office were amazing. Kind of reminds you of the Founding Fathers a little bit. But what your observations about what made him unique as president or his role in that part of history?
Well, let me say this. I said to somebody the other day, if you could take George Bush's most endearing personal qualities that have been discussed at the last 4 days and combine them with Donald Trump's courage, commitment to making America great again, what you would have would be the perfect president. But unfortunately, there's only one perfect man, and he lived 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I think that he would, many people will say he was defeated because of Ross Perot and the third party candidacy, but there never would have been a third party candidacy if he had been able to keep his pledge of no new taxes, in my opinion.
You know, one of the things I remember specifically about that race against Bill Clinton, Paul, I remember when it turned, he was Herbert Walker Bush was so far ahead in the polls and doing so well. And here comes Bill Clinton, and he starts playing his saxophone on Saturday Night Live and taking off his tie and sitting on stools. It was the first time presidents started, dumbing down the office. Before, there was gravitas, and George Herbert Walker Bush certainly had tons of gravitas. But he started trying to emulate Bill Clinton, sit on a stool, undo his tie, and be like an aw shucks guy, which he couldn't do. And honestly, I felt like that's the thing that killed him. It was trying to be someone that he was not, I think, is really what undid him. That's my personal opinion. But he was a great man, no question about it.
I think after the success of beating back Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War, at that point, his popularity in the country, it's hard to believe it now, his popularity in the country was in the 80s.
Yes, right.
Higher than Ronald Reagan's popularity had ever been, by far. And I think that there was kind of this focus on foreign policy without really knowing some of the social concerns that were out there in the country.
Yeah, same thing that's happening now. They didn't activate the base, which at that time was undeveloped, but was beginning to come awake because of, as you said, the decision on Roe versus Wade. Paul, I wish we had more time to talk, but I really appreciate you sharing those little tidbits, those little insights. That's really fun and interesting. And I know that you join me in wishing his family well and in thanking them for their service as a family led by his example of service to the country. So Paul Caprio, Family Pat Federal. Paul, thank you so much. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you. God bless President Bush and his entire family.
Yes, absolutely. All right, coming up next, we're going to Paris, so stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. In a moment of candor, Dylan Pontiff, one of the organizers of a Louisiana drag queen story hour event, admitted what many Christians have long known to be true. Pontiff, a self-described homosexual man who also performs in nightclubs as a drag queen, admitted the drag queen story hour events are intended to, quote, groom the next generation, end quote. He made the striking admission during a city parish council meeting. The world offers 3 to 8-year-olds drag queen story hours for grooming. The church often offers graham crackers and apple juice. We must evangelize and disciple our children. If we don't, the world will.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. There's another stalemate in Congress over funding for a border security wall. While the project will cost about $25 billion, the Democrats are refusing to give President Trump any more than $1.6 billion, and the Republicans are choking on his smallish request for just $5 billion. Donald Trump is president for one reason: his promise to build the wall. His base is anxious to see something happen and to catch at least a glimpse that the president is willing to go to the mat to keep his promise. In order to do that, he must refuse to compromise beyond his slimmed down request for $5 billion. If Congress sends him a bill with less, he needs to veto it. Otherwise, his base will begin to wonder if he really meant what he said, and the air will slowly start to leak out of his 2020 balloon.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio. Here's Walker Wildman for Redeem Clean Laundry Products.
Not only do you get a great product and you get to obviously clean your clothes, get the stains out and use the multi-surface cleaner to clean your countertops and use the dryer sheets, you're doing all of this and the money's going to support the work of American Family Association.
Redeem Clean Laundry Products were developed by AFA supporters Len Ingram and Jim Duncan to assist in funding the mission of the American Family Association. Redeem Clean products work as well as or better than other products on the market. They're environmentally safe, biodegradable, and they're made right here in the United States.
The great thing about Redeem Clean is not only is the product great, but it goes to support a great cause, and that is the work of American Family Association.
For clean laundry and a cleaner society, it's Redeem Clean. Visit redeemclean.afastore.net.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Trump decided over the weekend to pause further escalation in his use of tariffs as countermeasures in the economic war communist China has been waging against the United States for decades. His critics are deriding him for doing so on the basis of what are likely to prove to be more empty Chinese promises to buy additional American agricultural and other products. Actually, President Trump appears to have few illusions about China's past practices and future ambitions. He understands that we must counter effectively, for example, Beijing's massive espionage operations, intellectual property theft, cyber warfare, subversive influence operations here, as well as its aggressive military buildup and seizure, expropriation, and/or control of international waters, airspace, and strategic choke points. Mr. Trump and America must use whatever instruments, including further tariffs, are needed to address these present and growing dangers. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Protesters torched cars, vandalized buildings, and clashed with police this weekend in the worst riots to hit France's capital in over a decade. Even tear gas and water cannons struggled to disperse the angry crowd. More than 400 people were arrested and 133 people, including 23 police officers, injured. Parts of Paris this morning looked like a war zone. President Emmanuel Macron toured the damage, including this graffiti on the Arc de Triomphe, calling on him to resign. The so-called yellow vest protests, named after the safety vests worn by demonstrators, began 3 weeks ago. They were fueled by an increase in gasoline tax but have grown into a fierce fight against declining living standards.
All right, that's a report from CBS, and actually this is the third weekend that France has been under siege by rioters. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because as I watch these riots and as I read more and more about this, it just reminds me of home. And it reminds me of the dangers that we face here. The riots in France are very different than what we see in our streets with Antifa and other groups. And so we need to understand them. And how can we possibly, unless we talk to someone who's on the inside of things? So I'd ask a friend of mine, Alexandre Pessé. He's the Directeur of Institut de Formation Politique. How did I do, Alex? I met Alex in the Washington, D.C. when he was with the Alexis de Tocqueville Institute, which I think he still is. And Alexis de Tocqueville was a French historian who loved the United States. He wrote post-revolution about the wonders of the order, the social order here, when he went to the churches, and he said he understood the greatness. It's just a great story that he tells and encouraging. And France and the United States had such a strong bond. After all, they saved us during the revolution. And so what happens in France is important to us. We are connected. Alex, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Sandy. Glad to be with you. Good morning.
Alex, you know, sometimes when we see these videos and we hear these reports, it looks worse than it is. How bad is it from your perspective?
It happened that I went to the demonstration from the day one. And the first demonstration was very peaceful. I was even there with my kids. But then suddenly you had two new groups that joined the demonstration. You have a black box, which is like radical leftist, kind of anarchist, who usually write an A on the wall, that the one who destroy the house, destroy the bank, destroy the cars. And then you have another group called the Suburbians. It's usually people living in the suburbs from, generally from North Africa origin, who come more to steal things. And so the demonstration is like kind of hijacked by these two groups. But also, inside the demonstration, more and more people get mad at Macron because he treats them like they didn't exist. When they did the first demonstration, his government say that these people under their yellow jacket wearing a brown shirt. So basically, they were treated as fascists. And then the second thing is say, after the second demonstration, they say, okay, let's get to the table together. We're going to create a commission to discuss about environment, and the gilets jaunes, the yellow jersey, will be welcome. So people were first because they didn't go to debate ecology. They were there against taxes. The taxes are so high in France that people are just fed up.
Yeah, Alexandre, let me interject. I've been reading, of course, and my understanding, so correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm reading is that the yellow vests are basically people in the middle class who are suffering so much under the increased taxes, and now especially under the increased taxes on gasoline and petrol, whatever the other kind is. And they're actually not able to, they're actually being squeezed so hard that their standard of living is plummeting. I heard one of them say that there is no longer a middle class in France. It's only the upper class and the lower classes. All right, is that an accurate description of the yellow vests?
It's part of it. It's true. Yeah, that's true. The middle class are the one, the hardworking one, who has to pay for everything, has to not say anything, not complain, and then you have kind of a big part of the population who live under social help, some for real reason, for good reason, but some because they use the system. And on the other end, you have the elite, totally disconnected, who live in the center of Paris, who never has to fill their gas in their car because they have driver or cab. So that also explains the anger of the people because they are tired of this elite who doesn't want to hear them, who doesn't want to answer to them and just has them more tax and more taxes. And this is a drop that went over the thing. But yes, the middle class is the one being broken, and many people, many even French people who were successful, left the country, how sad it can be. We have 150,000 French from European origin who are leaving every year. And on the other hand, you have 500,000, mostly from African origin, coming to Europe, to France. So you can see how the differential is happening. And usually it's more people who need social help and the one leaving, or more the people who are ruining the country, make it worse.
Like, so it's just unbearable, really. It's unbearable to watch this happening in France and other and elsewhere. But I think France is really taking the brunt of it right now. I do think we should probably make it clear the connection between these rising petrol costs, whether it's gas or diesel, on the Paris Climate Accord. Could you talk about the connection there?
Yeah, just so you're... Our American friends know the see why French people are angry about this new tax. A gallon in the U.S., from what I remember, is $3.5, I think. In France, a gallon is more than $6. And 60% of the gallon is taxes. So they create new taxes to fight environment. People discover that this money were not supposed even to go for that. And so the Treaty of Paris and all these big meetings are usually an excuse for more taxation. So that's what people see more and more. They use big words and nice codes like the fight against racism, you have to accept any immigration. The fight against ecology, you have to accept any taxation. And people today are fed up. They don't want to open border and they don't want all taxation. And I think France is ready to be on the path to do like U.S. did, and elected an anti-establishment kind of president. They did the same in Austria. They're going to do the same in Italy, in Hungary, and I think it may happen in France too.
Boy, I hope so, Alexandra. Now, you know, I was reading, it reminded me very much of Louis XIV and Marie Antoinette, their lack of not paying any attention to the suffering of the people, which is what you're describing, it sounds to me like with your Prime Minister, Macron, that he doesn't really care. In fact, his words, as I'm reading his statements from the G20, you know, he promises they're going to come after the protesters, which, you know, no one wants. It doesn't sound to me like the yellow vests want burning, turning over of cars and burning Paris down. It sounds like these two other groups who have muddied the waters who are seeking that. But it makes it very difficult. You know, when you get these two other groups joining in, and your black box reminds me of our Antifa. I mean, do you know, is there a connection?
It's exactly that. And, you know, I was there in Avenue Kléber, the avenue that was the most destroyed in this demonstration. I was there on Saturday. I was there for 4 hours, and I saw two things. The first thing is what you call, you have a demonstration in the middle of the street, and on the side, you have this black box and these suburbians who break things and steal and just want to destroy. And the second thing that shocked me is that the police didn't intervene at all. They stay, there's like, at the end, we're like 500 people, and I think the one who were breaking everything was like 50 people maximum. They talk about 400 people arrested. I didn't see any of them being arrested. It's like they let them do, or maybe they're even encouraged. Many are starting to talk about that. So they could say the, you know, the yellow jersey are bad people, they're not credible, we have to go on. It's,
you know,
like
Alex,
the Tea Party. I feel so similar, like you went to the Tea Party, where people would organize and the elite just insult them and try to demonize them,
yes,
telling they're fascists, they're bad people, they're racist and everything.
Yeah, it's the same but different. I mean, it really is. I mean, this is what we're seeing too, Alex, is the police are standing by. Like when it is Antifa, now we've had a lot of it on the West Coast, and they really, the police have been so passive, it's just amazing. But it's the same tactic. It's the same tactic. It's like they all read the same book, the left. You know, I remember reading about Mao Zedong, how he went to Europe to study the European communist, to learn the methods of undermining and destroying and creating chaos in order to take power. He learned that from the Western communists and went back to China and did the same thing there. So it's the, it really is the same but different. It's chaos in order to take power. So, you know, so what's the recourse? Like for middle-class people who are just trying to survive, I saw one lady who lives out in the countryside. She and her family, they live a long way from shopping and civilization. I think they're farmers. And she was saying that they can hardly afford to drive their vehicles. And if they can't drive them, she said every month the money that she has to spend gets smaller and smaller because of the, all of the taxes. And it's really getting to be a desperate situation. So in your mind, what is the recourse? I'm guessing you don't favor burning down Paris. But what do you think the recourse is, Alex?
You're right about how the extreme left is organizing to create chaos. And what we see, and the danger that's going, now the left who infiltrated the movement start to say the Gilets Jaunes are fighting for fair tax, not against tax, for fair tax. They want more tax on rich people, like a Marxist kind of organization. To answer your question about how they're going to come out, Macron seems so stubborn, so arrogant, that I don't see how it's going to come out. I think he has to withdraw his tax, and he's going to have to go further with decreasing his tax. Otherwise, I don't even think his government will end the 5 years. He may have to dissolve the house, like to send election again. Not presidential race, he's going to stay in power for sure. But I think he could go to a new election of a new Congress in the months to come if he doesn't answer clearly.
So, Alex,
and on the future, for France, we tend to have a tradition of kind of revolutionary, which is not good. But when the situation goes so bad that we usually change regime, we kind of change the leadership, and so maybe that's what will happen in the months in the years to come. I'm pretty convinced about it, actually.
Alex, a quick question about something complex, just because I honestly don't know. You know, the British do change their governments if they're not happy. They have re-elections. They re-elect their prime minister. And in America, you know, our terms are fixed. So is France somewhere in between, are you saying?
It's the same in the sense that the president can say, now I call for election of the Congress again. Usually the Congress, the National Assembly, it's like the House for the U.S., is elected for 5 years. So technically there are 3 more years to go, 3.5 years. But the president can decide that he called for new election. So it, but him, I don't see him doing it unless he's touched really to the defense where there is no communication with the population anymore, no link. And that's what's going to, it's happening. Like people are like, there is a gap between the people and the government.
Yes.
Whatever they say, people don't believe them, don't support them. So I don't know how fast he can, how long he's going to stay like that with his house.
Yeah, it seems to be this epidemic, really, like a disease spreading all over Western Europe and the United States. It's just something we have to stand firm. I heard someone who used to be a leftist say, we have to decide how badly we want to fight for our freedoms. Do we want to fight for our freedoms as badly as others want to fight to take them from us? That's really the issue in France, and it's the issue in the United States. Alexandre Pessé, it's just such a pleasure, Alex, and we will pray for you, the people of France, and for you. When we see this in the news, we'll know how to pray. Thank you so much, Alex, and bonjour, and thank you. It's Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.